All right, I just wanted to welcome everyone to the EFF Three Strikes panel. Now, before we get started, in case anyone doesn't know, this is Mr. Scott Jones, and he's the guy who makes this possible every year. He's run the EFF track, and he puts a hell of a lot of time and effort into organizing the track, selecting speakers, selecting topics. So if you enjoy this at all, please stop by and thank him, because he's the one who makes this all possible. On a personal note, this is my fifth year speaking with the EFF track, and one of the reasons I come back every year, I guess besides women in spandex, is because I get to talk to guys like y'all. And every year, people who come to the EFF track are some of the smartest, most intelligent, best educated people I deal with all year. So every year when I give a speech, I honestly come away learning more from y'all than I feel like I give to you. So I don't want this to be a lecture. I want this to be a dialogue. If you, at any time you have something to share, something to add, just a different thought on the topic, we want to hear it. The only thing I ask is if we're talking or someone else is talking, just wait for them to finish. But raise your hand. We'll call on you, and I think we'll have a good time.
And we're recording the audience's questions, so he's just not talking into the void, so we'll bring a mic to you.
To begin with, I just wanted you to see a couple of the topics we'll be talking about today. That way, if you have any questions or you see a topic you want to talk about, you'll see you can just hold your question until we get to it. So obviously, this is a three strikes panel, and three strikes is a type of program called a graduated response. And over the past few years, the entertainment industry has developed an increasingly aggressive type of tactics towards file sharing programs, individual users, and online service providers. And this is their kind of latest proposal to stop online copyright infringement. Graduated response means that for each time a internet service provider or a copyright holder finds that you're infringing an online work, they graduate or elevate the threat to you. So maybe the first time they catch a user, they'll get a warning. Please, you've downloaded this file. That's our copyrighted work. Please do not do it again. If we catch you again, there will be severe penalties. Next time, they may, threaten to sue you. They may threaten criminal penalties. And it can go on and on. Usually a third strike, which is what we're talking about today, is the most popular, is when they cut off your service on the third notification. To begin with, in talking about copyright infringement, I think it's a good place to start is at the beginning. And in the United States, copyright really first began in the Constitution. And that was in Article 1, Section 8. And if you'll look up here, Section 8 of the Constitution is when they delegated powers to Congress. Now, before I show you the text of the Constitution that gave us copyright and patent protection, I think it's kind of interesting to note the placement of that. It was the eighth in the list of powers, and all of the powers up here actually were enumerated after copyright and patent protection. So that shows you that the drafters of the Constitution, even at that early point in history, really placed a lot of value on this. And this is really the basis for IP in the United States. And this section says, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to the respective writings and discoveries. Now that sentence combines both copyright and patent protection. And this, when you edit out the patent language, this is really the nugget that gave us copyright protection. So I think as we continue our discussion today, one thing that's kind of interesting is that with something this small, and there's not a lot of detail, but the thing that's kind of interesting about this is that it does give the purpose. It doesn't give a statutory framework or a scheme or different interpretations, but it says that the whole point in the very first line is to promote progress of useful arts. So in any discussion of copyright law, I think it's important to consider, is what we're doing, is it promoting progress? And if not, then what's the point? Well, now that we know where copyright comes from, I just want to give you kind of a quick history of the basics of copyright law. And the first thing to start with, what is copyright? What does it protect? And it protects, as it says in Section 102, original works of authorship fixed in any tangible medium of expression, now known or later developed, from which they can be perceived, reproduced, or otherwise communicated, directly or with the aid of a machine or device. Now, to be copyrightable, when you kind of filter out some of that language, what it really comes down to is that there's three absolute things for something to be copyrightable. It has to be a work of authorship, which means that you created it. You cannot have copied it from someone else. And it has to be original, which means that there's creativity. Now, that threshold is incredibly low. It just can't be something that has no expression or organization. And a good example is a phone book. If you think of white pages, you can put any name in there, and it's always going to go in the same spot because it's alphabetical. No matter what, there is no organization to it. It's almost like running a program. Now, yellow pages is something that actually has been held copyrightable. And the reason being is that the way that you classify and organize a business is unique. For example, McDonald's. One phone book might classify it as a restaurant. Another is fast food. Another is a health hazard. Whatever they want to classify it as, that's their own unique way of doing it. And finally, it has to be fixed. And fixed doesn't mean purely a physical thing. It means that there's some way to see it or reproduce it. For example, we're copywriting this speech and we're recording it. The fact that we could reproduce this means that it's copyrightable. If I was just talking to y'all, didn't record it, y'all could take anything I said and use it because I don't own it. So now that we know what is copyrightable, I think it's important to talk about what isn't. Copyright protects expression. It does not protect ideas, facts, phrases, names, logos, or functional items. And functional items is kind of a tricky subject. A good example is clothing. The fashion industry is one of the most profitable industries in the U.S., and they are constantly trying to get Congress to introduce legislation to allow copyright protection over clothing. And the reason they don't is that they feel that if something is useful, then it's not really, it's not an expression because it provides warmth, it provides protection from the elements. So there's a lot of things that you would think, you know, that's artistic, like say a lamp is a beautiful lamp, but it's a lamp, it's a functional item. You may be able to get some protection on a sculpture, but not a lamp. Now, in the Constitution, one of the phrases that was very important was that it gives authors the exclusive right to their writings. And the way that they've designed the protection of that is there are a couple of fundamental rights that the copyright owner has. These are to display a work, perform the work, distribute, reproduce, and prepare derivatives. A derivative is a work that's based on a pre-existing work that you own, such that it's been recast or transformed or somehow adapted, that there's now an additional amount of creativity so that it's now a new work. All right, now, when discussing copyright infringement, there's a couple of things I think they're very important. Direct infringement is the easiest to understand. That means that a person has intentionally, willfully taken someone else's work and used it for their own or reproduced it or sold it. That's to prove that, there's three things you always have to establish in a copyright infringement claim. First, you have to prove that you're an owner, that you have some right to what you're saying that someone else has infringed. Next, you have to prove that they copied it. One of the unique things about copyright, and it's something that most people don't realize, is that if I create something, say a song, and someone on the other side of the planet, having never heard that song, happens to create the exact thing, same thing. Even if it's 10 years later, if they've never heard my song, they own that song. They have all the rights I do to it.
And at work. And at work, for instance, the Land Down Under song recently was found to be infringing on a Girl Guide song in Australia. And if I remember right, they now have to pay $30-40 million in back royalties for We Live in the Land Down Under.
Mm-hmm. And one of the copyright litigation, one of the trickiest parts, and this is what most of litigation is based on, is you have to prove in that copying through either direct evidence or indirect evidence. Direct evidence means that you can prove that someone literally copied your work, and you can do that because they admit they copied it, or someone else has actual awareness that they copied it. The other way, and the most common, is through what they call indirect evidence. And that's done by, first, the test is striking similarity, which means that the work that you claim is yours and theirs is so similar that there's really, it's just unfathomable that they didn't look at yours and copy it. And to go along with that, they must have access to it. So to prove access, they either have to have been in a place where they could have seen it or known about it, and that they use that access. Well, now you've heard all about ownership and rights and how we protect the owners. But really, when you look at the Constitution, it's supposed to be a balance. We're giving exclusive rights to authors, but we're trying to promote the useful arts. So now let's talk a little bit about how we protect users and consumers, those of us who purchase copyrighted items. One of the most important limitations to a copyright is a limited duration, and that's in the Constitution by securing for limited times. Now, up until a few years ago, it was the life of the author plus 50 years. If you've heard of the Sonny Bono Act, this changed that. It added an additional 20 years to this. There's a lot of talk about how that could be extended indefinitely. There's so much money in copyrighted works and music and movies that every time an extension is about to run out, there's already legislation in the works to extend it. There's also a number of very important limitations on the copyright. The one that's probably the most useful is called the first sale doctrine. And without this, it would literally be impossible to share, resell, lend, or even talk about creative works. For instance, if you tried to sell a CD or lend a book to a friend, that implicates a copyright owner's exclusive right to distribute the work. Quoting from a news article or your favorite movie on the blog can implicate the reproduction right. Singing aloud implicates a performance right. So with the first sale doctrine, what that does is say that when you've purchased something, some of those rights are cut off, so that unique item is now yours. You can then resell it, you can give it to someone, you can throw it away, but you really can't copy it and allow it to be reproduced. And that's generally when we talk about infringement on the internet, those are the rights that are being infringed. As I mentioned earlier, independent creation is another one. So that there's a lot of things in copyright that, because of the nature of the work, for example, say a picture of a cat or a video of a cat. You can look on the internet. There's just thousands of them. Why not? They're adorable. So at some point, there's going to be a cat that looks like another cat. The fact that, you know, there's going to be some similarities. If it's my picture, if I didn't steal yours, there's no problem. And then fair use. Fair use balances a creator's need for protection against our right to be able to use it. And in determining it, and this is what's kind of tricky, is that copyright's a law. Fair use is a guideline. There's no absolute test where you can just point to something and say that's fair use. It's always an argument, and that's always kind of the infringer or the alleged infringer's duty to say that it is fair use. The copyright holder just has to claim infringement. And when looking at this, there's a couple of things they look at. the purpose and character of the use, including whether such use is commercial nature or nonprofit, educational. They also looked at the nature of a work. Is it fact-based so that there's a little protection? Is it very creative? Is it a poem? Is it something that has a lot of different things that are protectable? How much of the work is taken? There's so many movies that, like for example, Avatar. When Avatar came out, everyone loved the 3D, but instantly online, everyone's like, Fern Gully, Dances with Wolves. You know, there's so many things that were similar. And a lot of people were expecting, and I think he actually was sued by someone for copyright infringement. But I think ultimately they decided that there was similarities, but not enough to be infringing. And then, of course, the most important one, and this is why fan art is generally allowed and actually encouraged by copyright owners, is what is the effect on the market? One of the best tests is if what you're doing, if you're making money, copyright owners are thinking, you're taking money from me. So if you're just doing something for fun, if you're not harming their market, generally you won't get sued. Okay, that's all we're going to do on copyright law. And now that we've done that, let's talk a little bit about the internets. What this is really about is how, within the last 15 years, distribution of digital content has become incredibly easy. The internet was originally designed on the client-server model. That means that a client contacted the server, requested something like a web page or a file, they sent it back. But there are some problems with this. If too many people are requesting the same thing from a server at once, download speeds tanked. Or if the server was down, the file is just unavailable. So then peer-to-peer came along. And instead of having to rely on one server, now a file can be hosted on multiple servers, which means that instead of a network decreasing with more users, the speeds and upload actually increases because now more people are hosting a file. And because of this, it's made distribution of files such as music, movies, software incredibly easy, incredibly fast. And this is why the entertainment industry has really just gone to enormous effort to put a stop to this. Now, there's really two big players in the U.S. as far as online infringement. That's the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, and the Motion Picture Association of America. And both of these are very strongly opposing copyright infringement on the internet. And their biggest target is peer-to-peer software, originally. I know everyone used Napster and Aimster, Grokster, Kazaa, LimeWire. That was their first big targets, because that's the software that you had to use to search for music, to search for movies, and then to download it. So, of course, they filed lawsuits, and most of these have either been bankrupted or gone out of business or have become some sort of legitimate file-sharing site. But, of course, as soon as that happens, as soon as you have to pay or it doesn't have infringing content, users would switch to a new technology. And the most recent and probably the most difficult for the entertainment to deal with is BitTorrent. And the reason this is so difficult for them is it was easy with Kazaa. We're suing Kazaa. You're the one who's allowing users to do this. With BitTorrent, there's not a central place for them to sue. Now they have to go after individual people. And one of the biggest problems with that is, sure, we can sue people. We can get huge judgments against them, and they have. A good example is the RIAA in two cases. One was versus Joel Tenenbaum. They found that he shared 30 songs, and they used statutory damages of $22,500 per song and got a judgment of $675,000 against him. Now, Joel was, I think he was in his late 20s.
And it was 2003 the original offense occurred. He was, I think, 21 at
right.
the time.
So, fine, you've got a judgment of, you know, more than $500,000 against a 21-year-old.
And at the same time, it's taken 7 years so far to get that initial judgment.
Now, a legal term that lawyers hate is judgment proof. And that means that, you know, I've sued you, I've won a judgment of $5 million. You're 21, you know, you've got maybe a couple $100 in your checking account. I've got the judgment, I'm never going to see a dime. So suing individual users, not only was it incredibly unpopular, it caused a lot of backlash, but the money they would spend on these suits was so exorbitant and the return was incredibly minimal. So in 2008, they just kind of announced, we're going to stop suing individual users. Now, they did say in certain cases, if someone is just flagrant, we reserve the right to sue them. But they just found that it just wasn't worth their time. They still send out thousands and thousands of takedown notices. But their new strategy is, instead of dealing with the user, let's deal with the gateway. Let's deal with the internet service provider. If we can get them to work with us so that if someone's caught infringing, we don't have to sue them, we don't have to go through due process and litigation, we just get them kicked off the internet. Problem solved. And that's really what three strike programs are about, is if they found you, and you can probably fill in on this, is when they give you three strikes, there's no due process. They don't have to prove that you did anything. They don't have to determine whether what you were doing was fair use. And if you live in an area where there's only a single internet service provider, and that's in the U.S., that's quite a bit of the area, but around the world, most people have one place they can go to in their geographic location, you're now cut off from the internet. And I know that on one hand that's like a big whoop. I mean, imagine your livelihood. Imagine a modern day person trying to hold a job if you can't send and receive email, if you can't research, if you can't, you know, keep up with modern times. The framework that the entertainment industry is using to really enforce it is U.S. law. And the most important of this is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So we're going to go through a couple of those provisions and kind of see how this framework is being used to pressure internet service providers. One of the first ones, and the very important one, is Section 512A. And this limits internet service providers from copyright liability for simply transmitting information over the internet. So it's basically, if they're just a mere conduit, if they're a dumb pipe, then they have a safe harbor. They can just say, hey, they used us, we didn't know about it, not our fault. But the law states that if they have the ability to control it, if they're aware of infringing activity, then they're supposed to lose that right. Now, this is kind of in the air. There was a recent decision in YouTube versus Viacom, and basically what it held is that even if a host knows that there's infringing activity going on, if a copyright holder sends them a takedown notice and they comply, even though they're aware of that activity, they're still shielded by the safe harbor law. So this was a huge loss for the RIAA, and it's really pushing them, instead of just to deal with U.S. law, they're now trying to push globally. One of the most potent aspects of the DMCA is Section 512A, and this states that if an ISP has adopted and reasonably implemented a policy that provides for the termination in appropriate circumstances of subscribers and account holders of the service provider's systems or networks who are repeat infringers. What that basically says is they need to have a system in place so that if copyright holders make them aware that someone continues to infringe, that they should have some sort of consequence, that either you throttle their speed, you bump them off for a period of time, or you disconnect them completely. Now, I'm not aware of any provisions that require an internet service provider to actually take these notices and then send them to a user, but they seem to be doing it anyways. And there's really legitimate reasons for them. One of the biggest is it makes great financial sense. So many ISPs are now offering services where they need to be in bed with the entertainment industry. If you want video on demand, movies on demand, if these are the services that your clients want, you've got to have content. So instead of fighting with the entertainment industry, instead of telling them, look, we're sick of dealing with these copyright notices, you can go to hell, the law is protecting us, we've got a safe harbor, maybe we'll work with you. Especially if you kind of give us a deal on, you know, the rights for these movies and for TV. So one of the, as I mentioned earlier, trickiest parts about this is that There's no real oversight. EFF, which is who hosts this track, has said that the DMCA has been used to invade the privacy of internet users, harass internet service providers, and chill online speech. And these subpoena and takedown powers, where they can find the identity of the user that the ISP provides to them, that there's no, you know, judge's review. There's no real protection for the consumer. So what's going on, and what's really kind of got this is something everyone's talking about is ACTA. And this is the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement. And it's basically an international treaty or agreement for the purpose of establishing international standards on intellectual property right enforcement. Now, countries who are part of this are saying that this is a response to the increase in global trade of counterfeit goods and pirated copyright works. What this would do is establish a framework that countries can join on a voluntary basis, but it exists outside of their governing bodies. It's outside of the World Trade Organization, the World Intellectual Property Organization, and the United Nations. In a lot of the controversy, there's multiple parts of this, but regarding online infringement, is that this was basically held in secret. Multiple people in the U.S. had sent Freedom of Information requests, you know, just tell us what's going on, just make it transparent. And both the Bush and Obama administration for years refused to do so. There recently has been some leaks. There's also been a condensed version that's come out. And they have said that, I think it was in April of this year, that they've taken mandatory graduated response for signing countries off the table. But they've kind of left some provisions in that they're very worrying. To still be under a safe harbor provision, an online service provider has to adopt and reasonably implement a policy to address unauthorized storage or transmission of materials protected by copyright. Now, this provision was drafted by the U.S., and it very almost mirrors the language of the DMCA takedown provision. And there's actually, in some of the earlier leaked texts, they said an example of this type of system would be a mandatory three-strike rule. Well, I'll leave this up, but I wanted to give him a chance to go ahead.
Okay. Well, my name's Andrew Norton. I'm the legal director of the U.S. Pirate Party. I'm also the former head of Pirate Party International, and I'm a peer-to-peer researcher. Mainly what I've been focusing on is how three strikes has been implemented elsewhere in the world. Ireland, for instance, if you can go back to slide 19, has this, you see this liability that they only get protection if it's a dumb pipe. Well, in Ireland, for instance, there was a High Court ruling last year where the main ISP, IRCOM, has to cut people off if they get three notifications. They fought it and it went through the High Court and they lost. So 800 notices went out against Irish broadband users in June alone. The big problem though, and it's the biggest problem with all three strike systems, is the evidence requirement. There's very little required in the way of evidence. There just has to be an allegation. You infringed my copyright. That's an allegation. That's one strike. A month later, you infringed my copyright again. Another strike. The basis of most evidence is screenshots, logs, or monitoring programs. There's no chain of evidence. If you were to be arrested by the police, any evidence materials taken off you, sealed in a bag, signed for. If it was tampered, we'd know who had it and when. With this kind of evidence, there's no such chain of custody. Anybody can tamper it. It's a text file, it's an image file. We've all got text editors, we've all got Photoshop. It doesn't take very long just to change the evidence a little to target whoever you want or don't want, and there's no oversight over it. There's no regulation.
Yeah? Is there anything to tell who the end user is if I have internet?
If I have internet and I'm sharing wirelessly with my neighbor, how do they know that it's my neighbor or me?
There's no way to tell. They only ever target the account holder. They hold the account holder responsible, and then they've reversed what's the presumption of innocence is now the presumption of guilt. You have to prove you are innocent. Now, there's been two copyright cases we showed about before about Tenenbaum and Jamie Thomas. That was it. And what isn't commonly known is there have been two other cases that have gone all the way to court. And one of them was Tanya Baker. And the RIAA turned around and said, okay, we admit you didn't share, you didn't infringe. And we'll sign a thing and say, yes, you didn't do it, and we're sorry. Our evidence was wrong. But that never comes up when it comes to discussing three strikes. And they ended up having to pay $200,000 in legal fees.
Right.
By the way, just for what he just mentioned about your neighbor going off your Wi-Fi, that's one of the reasons that you really don't want to share your open Wi-Fi, because that puts you at legal risk that they will come looking for you. And that's not really part of this discussion, but you can get sucked in by this because there aren't the legal protections.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the same time, going back to ICOM in Ireland, in 2007, the wireless routers that were being supplied by ICOM were Netopia models, had very, very weak wireless encryption protocol systems where the security key was based on the SSID, the ID code that was set by ICOM. So it was trivial for anybody to hack these, to jump onto these routers, and they could infringe at will, and there was nothing that could be done. And yet, 3 years later, plenty of people still using those routers, three notices, and they're cut off. And they've just signed an agreement with Vodafone, which is owned by Verizon in Ireland. And between them, that's two-thirds of all ISP subscribers in Ireland who are now subject to ISP-based three strikes. In France, there is the HADOPI law, the Haute Autorité pour la Diffusion de l'œuvre de la Protection des Droits d'Internet. The high authority of the diffusion of the artworks and protection of the copyrights on the internet. That's a mandated three-strike procedure in law. Now, it was struck down by the Constitutional Court last year because it had no judicial oversight at all. It contravened the rights of man. Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. For presumption of innocence, separation of powers, and freedom of speech. Those three things are the basis of every single three strikes legislation proposed worldwide at present. The UK recently passed the Digital Economy Act, where again, three strikes. And here's the kicker as well. If you want to appeal, right now, the idea is you have to pay to appeal. And you have to go to a special tribunal body set up by the communications regulator, Ofcom, their version of the FCC. And you have to pay to appeal. And if you fail, you've lost your money and you've got that strike against you. The amusing thing was they justified it in the documents as it's because when the Australian censorship filter came up, the filter was packeted, slash-dotted. Want of a better term, and having people pay will stop people from flooding it with appeals. And finally, New Zealand also got a three-strike system in place. It's called Section 92A. But after a big public uproar, it was pulled. The government actually turned around and pulled it. But now they're thinking of putting a new one in again. The strange thing about these laws is, in almost every case, they're passed suspiciously. The UK government as many people may know, recently had a change of government from the Labour Party to the Conservative Party. The Digital Economy Act was passed in a process called wash-up, which went through after the election was called, and they had a period of 1 week to pass any bills still outstanding. The entire bill got 2.5 hours of debate. That was it. Then it was voted in the next day. In France, they tried to pass it on the sly. They tried to sneak in at lunchtime and pass it when everybody else was not there. The first time, I think it was the Socialist Workers' Party snuck in as well. And they snuck in 20 people to defeat that bill, 15 to 20. So they went and passed it through again. And both times it was passed through as a matter of urgency. It was so urgent, it only got one debate period. And it was, of course, favoured by Carla Bruni, singer and songwriter, wife of French President Nicolas Sarkozy. So there's a big power gap, power linkage between copyright. Lord Mandelson was the one behind the Digital Economy Act. Was strangely in favour of it right after coming back from a holiday in the Greek island of Corfu, after spending an evening on DreamWorks founder David Geffen's yacht. You know, it's strange, he had no interest, he goes away on holiday, comes back, where are we on this copyright infringement thing? They actually issued a second consultation document right after he got back to push the three strikes aspects. So we've got that major problem. Now, going on to the evidence we need, it's been well proven that much of it has been falsified. There's an amusing study in May 2008 by the University of Washington where they were monitoring BitTorrent streams. And they added fake peer info. They created peer addresses, IP addresses, and sent those to the trackers. They got 281 DMCA notices for that. They didn't share a single byte. Under a three strikes provision, they'd have been cut off the internet, 91 times. 18 of those were completely spoofed. There were network printers, routers, just like one right back there. There were computers that weren't turned on, but just assigned by the university. There was no proof that there was any infringement, but there was just the allegation. And that's all that Three Strikes needs.
As I recall, part of the DMCA was that there's a requirement for the RIAA and that due diligence that they have to check to see if those are in fact legitimate servers. Is that true? And if they don't and continue putting out complaints, they can lose their right to complaint. Is that correct?
I don't believe so. I know there is a provision where if they've sent a takedown notice, the alleged infringer can respond and they can say that they can argue fair use and they can kind of have a chance to prove it. But it's not a simple thing. It's something most people have to hire a lawyer to do. And that's what's so tricky about it, is that it's almost a penalty to prove that you didn't do anything. And one of the things that's so tricky about fair use is that in fair use, commenting, as in news reporting, means that you can take portions of music, of movies, of TV, of sports, and put them on their net and comment on them, review them. They have some very sophisticated software, and YouTube is amazing with what they can do now. They can literally take a song that's been remixed, that's been slowed down, recorded over, and they can identify it by unique codes. So if they find even a snippet of something that is just a hallmark of fair use, that still counts. And the only way you can get it back up is to go through this process, and it's a lot of work.
Okay, but by the same token, YouTube takedown notices, because they're automated, they've actually had that fair use problem, and they're not actually technically DMCA notices. They're mm-hmm. just notifications of infringement. Otherwise, it would take the mandatory 4 days before it could come back up. What else was I going to say? There's also, when we talk about these three strike laws, they keep saying, I'm sure we've all seen, the industry's losing billions. We're losing billions here, losing billions there. The most famous story was the Lek Publishing with the MPAA in 2005. They said, we're losing $6.4 billion in 2005 to peer-to-peer file sharing. They never provided a single bit of proof. 9 months later, they turn back around and say, oops, see this act, this number here that we used to prove this was so bad, and we actually got you to pass higher education act where universities had to have a copyright infringement strategy because of universities. Well, this 45% should really have been 15%. And they only found that out when they were coming to do the next study and realized the numbers were really out of whack between them. There's no data provided, there's no evidence, there's no source, there's no nothing.
I was curious, what would you suggest that the people here would be able to do about these sort of policies, about copyright in general and the fact that it keeps getting extended and extended and extended? I personally feel like copyright's a good thing. It should provide the creator with some income for some amount of time. I don't necessarily know that should be the entire lifetime, but you know, some set of years or lifetime. But then once you start providing the funds beyond that, you get into basically building dynasties and people just, you know, siphoning off the system forever. So aside from writing letters to Congress people and supporting organizations like the EFF, are there other suggestions you gentlemen have about what the people here should be doing in order to fight against three strikes and try to protect our rights, both in fair use and hopefully in maintaining public domain content as it's supposed to be utilized?
Absolutely, and I do agree with you. I'm a very pro supporter of copyright owners' rights. I'm just against the lack of due process here. You know, I have no problem with someone who creates a movie, puts millions of dollars into creating a, you know, great entertainment, saying, you know, please pay for this. But I guess to your question, I think the best thing, and I think everyone in here can do this, is that think about who your representatives are. Like, one thing I do is I volunteer as an advisor, an IP advisor, to a congressman in Alabama. That's where I'm from. And you have to understand, most politicians, I know they've got the worst name out there, probably worse than lawyers, is they really are just some of the hardest working people. And what is so difficult about being a politician is that you are basically required to be an expert on every subject. You need to know about everything from farming to agriculture to business to IP to, I mean, just if it's something that affects someone, you need to be able to have a speech ready and have some opinion. And most, I mean, think about it, most people who are in office, there's a huge age gap between who's in this room and who's in office. Most of them, you know, the internet came around when they're in their 50s. They're not as technologically savvy. They do not understand the issues. But you'd be surprised if you call one of them and say, look, there's an issue, and I'm not going to yell at you for it, but if you ever want to talk about it, if you're confused, it's something I understand, I'd be happy to talk with you. They're thrilled. I mean, they have to put on this act so much of their life that I know everything, but they don't, and they really struggle. And I mean, you know, this is what I do for a living, and there's parts of this law that is just confuses the hell out of me. Imagine if, you know, what it's like for someone who's never studied law. Someone
like me.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. And that's just one thing on their plate. So my advice is, wherever you live, wherever your representatives are, call them. Don't yell at them. Don't say, I've got something to tell you about and I'm angry. Say, I've got an issue I care about. I'd be happy to talk with you. I'd be happy to, you know, advise you. I'd be happy to explain why this is important. Here are the ramifications. Also, run for office. How old are you?
I'm 30.
30. I'm 1 year older, and he's held huge political positions. It always seems like to me, when I think about politics, that's got to be at least 15, 20 years before I'm even close to being ready. But it's not. Young people are so powerful, and we're so smart, and we're so technologically savvy that you can reach. I mean, think of social networking. This is something most politicians don't understand. They don't understand the reach that you can use. You can reach your friends, your friends' friends. You can have thousands of supporters in no time. And if you run for office, you can get elected. And I'd love for you to share your experience on that.
Yeah, one of my friends is actually a member of the European Parliament, and she's 22. She's actually the youngest European Parliament member they've ever had, and she is for the Swedish Pirate Party, the Swedish Pirate Party. And of course, you could always support your local Pirate Party. If there isn't a state one, contact me, and we'll see about getting you a state party sorted. I mean, personally, I'm a writer. I'm working on a couple of books. I'm a robotics engineer by training and education. I've done patents. I even worked as a copyright enforcer while I was in college, dealing with commercial copyright infringement in the bars and clubs around the Mediterranean. So I've seen all sides of it, and some of the tactics nowadays disgust me, frankly. That's why I started with the pirate parties.
Cliff, I do have a question. Mm-hmm. And I don't know who's doing the suing, but currently a website, The Armed Citizen, is down because some organization bought up rights from these small papers.
Newspaper one, yeah.
And they're going around, and basically what The Armed Citizen did is any case anywhere in the U.S. that someone used a firearm in self-defense or any of these things, you know, information that in the aggregate is incredibly useful for anyone crafting, you know, state laws or looking at these issues, is currently down over an infringement saying, oh, you can't talk about or publish excerpts from newspaper articles. How does that even, I don't know if it's an injunction or they took it down to avoid a bunch of money until it gets resolved, but how does that happen under the copyright laws that we have?
I'm really not familiar with this issue. Is this something?
Yeah, I think it's a Las Vegas-based company where they're going around the country, and you've heard of patent trolls, where mm-hmm. people buy up patents and then sue anybody that comes close. Well, this is a company that's I can't think of the name off the top of my head, but they're going around suing a lot of newspapers who for infringements, and it's a business model to the company. That's all they do now. They just want money. But they're using it, I believe it's a DMCA notice where they got to take it down, or they've got to contest it within 4 days, or else they get the heavy penalties. And it can be, you know, it's just as expensive to settle as it is to hire a lawyer to start fighting it. So that's where the business model aspect comes of it.
And in this case, they took down the entire website. I suppose they think, hey, maybe they're connected to the NRA or something, so there's money. So they get something straight for a full-blown infringement suit.
I think a settlement is usually $600 per article. And if there's multiple articles, even if they don't own the rights, it's been known for companies to say, okay, we got the rights to that. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, you know, $37,000, please, or else we'll take you to court and sue you.
And that's the thing that's kind of tricky about copyright, is copyright is automatic. You automatically have copyright protection the moment the work comes into existence. And so many people these days are like, well, why register? I've got protection. Registration gives you very significant rights, especially in litigation. One of those is statutory damages, which means that even if I haven't been harmed in any way, you haven't, you know, I haven't lost any income, for every act of infringement, you can get a set amount of damages. And I think that's probably the scheme they're working is,
yeah,
you either pay us, you know, a couple grand or 10 grand or whatever, or we have these many acts, we've proved ownership, we've proved you've used it, we've proved that you probably had access to it, we are going to win. It may take us a year of litigation, you're going to probably spend a few $100,000 in legal fees, and then you're going to have to pay damages on top of that. Or you can pay us 10 grand and we'll go away.
That's exactly what it is. When the UK acts are being, the UK Digital Economy Act is being pushed through, there's a company that does the same sort of thing, but uses gay porn. It's had Nazi porn, and it's been targeting elderly couples in places, and games, movies, music. It's a company called ACS Law. And they do this sort of procedure where they'll send in a notice and they'll say, okay, you've got to pay up the settlement, £500. That's $700. Or else we're going to take you to court. They've been sending these notices out now for 5 years. There has been 6 cases total, all of them default judgments when the person has not shown. Mm-hmm. And they'll just use that matter. It's a 10% ratio. If only 10% of the people pay up, it's money in the bank. There's actually companies done that. But they don't need any kind of evidence for it. They'll just say, pay up, or else you're going to pay more to defend it.
Mm-hmm.
And the act of being passed, one of the members of the House of Lords stood up and said, this practice is extortion by, because it's the same process that was being proposed for the bill, the exact same process that was being used by those lawyers was being proposed for the Digital Economy Act in Britain. So,
and kind of the way these schemes work is that in U.S. law, attorney's fees, which are very rarely given to a defendant, as in you don't get if someone sues you, you don't automatically, if you win, if you prove that you were innocent, that doesn't mean that the other side has to pay for your defense. And so this is actually a huge strategy with patent trolls. What they do is, as long as they can prove that their claim was somewhat justified, if I can prove that our patents, you know, maybe you weren't exactly infringing, but they look pretty close. The average cost to defend a patent claim is, I think, $800,000 to $1.5 million. So say you're a software company and you've got 20 employees and you get a notice that says you're infringing my patents. You can either pay me $100,000 or we can go to court. You can spend every dime you have to prove that you were innocent, but now you're bankrupt. So then I'll just buy whatever's left of you at auction. And then if you have patents, I'll buy those when you go bankrupt, add them to my portfolio, and use those to keep steamrolling others.
Where do you feel the responsibility for IP traffic starts and begins? From the regional internet registries to the ISPs, and then the ISPs to the users, then the users, what they choose to do with their routers and various things like that. There's a disconnect at all levels there, and where do you think it starts and ends? Myself and my coworker here have worked for an ISP for about a decade, and a little more than a decade now, and I can see that there can be an irresponsibility at all levels. Regional internet registries could be giving out IP blocks to people that maybe have not demonstrated a reasonable level of responsibility of who they assign the IP addresses to, and certainly I know from where we work there is some disconnect of we're not sure of who our users are, and that could be easily argued that we need to shore that up. And then obviously the end result is what the users are doing with that traffic. Now obviously overall there's a whole culture of disconnect. People don't feel that those IP addresses are theirs. Are they the ISP services IP addresses? Were they ultimately the internet registries IP addresses? Where do you feel that responsibility kind of lies, and where should it be pressured at, or where do you think you see it going?
I really think that's a fascinating question. And really the worst thing I think anyone can feel is to know there's a problem and not have a good solution. And the thing is, this is such a complex problem. Before I was a lawyer, I used to be an electrical engineer, and still I have a disconnect on a lot of the issues you're talking about because it's just outside my sphere of knowledge.
What if there's something else? If we go to IPv6, that's going to be higher and that's even more
eight, is it?
Potential 1,000 IP addresses.
As we go to IPv6, you know, there's going to be literally, you know, hundreds, if not 1,000 IP addresses per person on the planet, something in that scope, and a complete redefinition of the end user based on how that IPv6 structure works. And my feeling from being in this for about a decade is I think it's going to come from bottom up as opposed to from top down. I think when the culture of the user understands that there's a certain amount of responsibility, and I know for myself, you know, having been in my early 20s and now in my late 30s, as I've gotten a little older, I'm like, I start to pay attention a little more to what I'm doing, and my friend here has worked in the gaming industry. I'm like, I don't want to pirate stuff anymore necessarily, because I know people that work on this stuff, and I don't know, I think it's going to start, my feeling is going to start from the culture, and that's going to take a long time because this is so new. How are we going to foster an entire culture of personal responsibility within an internet community that's not even done developing yet? And I think that lends that instability there at the end user level, with, I said, at the introduction of IPv6 already. But when that gets to the user level, I think that needs to solidify now. I'm guessing it's going to go up from there, but I don't know. I wanted to hear a little more what you guys had to say.
Actually, I really agree with you. And one thing that I think is kind of an interesting note on that topic is iTunes. Something Apple said a few years ago, Steve Jobs, is that if you want to end piracy, you don't try to stop it, you compete with it. He realized that people had quit doing the CD model. Because, I mean, think about it. I remember buying CDs, and then I would do it because I wanted two songs. I didn't want the other 13 crap songs. And so now, all of a sudden, I have a choice of paying $18 for, you know, a bunch of stuff I don't want, or I can just get it free. Now, the thing is, I really do think, and they've proven this, if you give people a choice that's equally as easy between doing something legal and something illegal, 90% of the time, they'll take the legal route. But if the legal route is much more difficult, much more expensive, much more time-consuming, the illegal route is easy and free, that's where they're going to go. So I think as distribution, as technology, and as business models change, I think it's going to kind of curb naturally some aspects of it.
Yeah, that's true. Because again, in the UK, there's a recent example. Spotify is a music streaming system, a bit like Pandora, and they've been doing some research, and they found that people are downloading less. Spotify members are downloading less music than non-members. It's not an exact science, obviously, but when they have the option where they can just stream what they want when they want, they can.
Okay.
Don't press that one.
Is that on yours?
Yeah.
What
do you do? I don't know. Yeah, I was kind of wondering myself. I was like, that's not my cell phone setting that off, is it?
No, when the battery goes dead, it kind of loses its mind.
Batteries last about 2 hours in that thing.
Oh, guys, we've hit our hour mark. I'm more than happy to stay as long as anyone else wants, but if you have other panels or if you've got a schedule to keep, I just want to let you know.
I think our next session's at 1.
Okay.
But one final point is something the renowned blogger, writer, columnist, and activist Cory Doctorow wrote about 2 years ago. He said, if you want to go for a three strikes model, great. But there has to be a three strikes model for enforcers as well. If you make three false accusations, you're cut off from making any kind of accusations ever again. And that will pretty much kill the business models of that newspaper one, because they can't risk getting three judgments against them and all of a sudden all that money they've spent buying that stuff, hiring the people, getting the software, it's gone because they've got no internet access. The same with ACS Law, anybody doing this. But there's very little accountability. You've probably got better numbers, but the DMCA has, well, you've got to certify under penalty of perjury that the information in the DMCA notice is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
How many perjury cases have there been on that?
I don't think I recall any.
None. Yeah. I haven't found a single one. I spent the last week looking. There has not been a single perjury case over a false DMCA claim. I can tell you of thousands. Chilling Effects, is it .org?
Mm-hmm, .org.
Has lists of all of thousands of bogus claims, of DMCA claims. Each one of those, technically, is perjury. And yet there's no punishment for it. But we get a single copyright infringement, that's $750 minimum damages.
Actually, I just wanted to point out real quick, you were talking earlier about to get involved in the government, try to get active in your area. Mm-hmm. A lot of the things that we're talking about here with the, that one company that's just kind of throwing out the accusations and encouraging the spending of legal fees and such, a lot of that kind of frivolous lawsuit activity, there are broader legislations that are trying to combat that. So it affects not only tech industry and intellectual property, but also, you know, medical costs, many other things. So these are issues that ring true not only with us, but also with even completely non-technical individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it.
I was wondering if there's been any countersuits when people are innocent, and also, is there a place we could find a list of all the cases that have been going on?
The only countersuit I'm aware of was the Tanya Baker case, where she ended up countersuing. Mm-hmm. I think it was dismissed in the end, most of the charges, right. The racketeering, the RICO, all that sort of thing. But she did get her legal fees awarded, mm-hmm. which was, I say, I think it was $291,000. But that case, apparently they were stalking her. They pretexted where they were impersonating her child's grandmother at school to try and get hold of the people and try and intimidate them because of the way the lawsuits go. Mm-hmm. It's a two-lawsuit process usually. First is a John Doe lawsuit, and they'll go through... they'll push it straight through to discovery to get the information. And it's very hard to object to it without revealing your identity and making the lawsuit. Then they'll dismiss the lawsuit. Once they get your identity, they'll cancel that lawsuit, and then they'll stop pressuring you personally. And then when you finally won't crack, then they'll go for the lawsuit again. And that's where you get a lot of the problems with the countersuits, because it's got to get to that point, and people are, leave me alone, sort of thing, you know. And they'll pay up, and they'll sign anything they can.
Quick question, a little bit on American law here. So you have a copyright judgment against an individual bordering on $1 million, mm-hmm. which would normally push someone pretty much to pop a Chapter 7 on right. them if there were any significant collections efforts. But judgments of that type are often are excluded from bankruptcy. So how is that justice for someone who finds themselves prosecuted at that level, and then they have no relief at all from the government? Where does that fit in as far as justice and under the, as far as that goes? You could chase someone until they're and seize pretty much everything they have over minimum wage for the rest of their lives.
And the thing is, in both of these cases, those massive awards were ultimately reduced by the judge. But still, when you think of Tenenbaum, he went from $675,000 to $67,000. Still, when you're a young guy, that is just, that's going to hang over your head pretty much, until you're...
At least 10 years to work
right.
on that.
And it's basically, you share a couple of songs, it's like buying a house that you don't get to live in.
So he filed an appeal last week on that, but mm-hmm. if you look at the size of these awards... I don't know about Georgia law, but I know in California there's 30 songs, let's say 10 tracks on an album. If you shoplift 3 times in California, you actually take the CD, it is a maximum penalty of $1,000 per CD. Now if you were to infringe those same 10 items, it's a minimum of $750 per track. So it's either $1,000 for stealing it, actually stealing the CD, or $7,500 minimum for just for possibly infringing the content. And that's a huge disconnect, especially as there's no actual loss proven. There's a loss if you steal a CD. The store doesn't have the CD to sell. And it can go as far, 10 tracks alone could take you to $1.5 million in damages. That's the range. $750,000 to $150,000.
I wanted to ask what you both felt about internet service and its kind of analogous view as a utility as we go forward. Obviously, in the past, people move into a house, they get their electricity turned on, they have their water turned on, they have their phone turned on, cable TV turned on, and now internet. Well, let's just say the last two have gone away. You have your power turned on, you have your water turned on, you have your internet turned on. But those last two things in most markets, are, which is phone and cable, are regulated by agencies, whether they be local or federal. And a lot of cases, it is actually, in fact, federal. There's commissions and service things that overview how they're being handled. But as far as internet service is concerned, that's not exactly as regulated. And as you guys pointed out, losing your internet service is more serious than losing your phone, more serious than losing your cable, and I would even offer it's bordering on as important as your electricity or water in some cases, depending mm-hmm. on your, you know, if you use that for your living. So where do you see that going as far as government intervention into that? And my feeling is that the offering and regulation of that is going to move into some sort of commission or something. That's the way I feel it going. What do you guys think about that?
Well, when I moved house 2.5 years ago, the very first thing I did, before power, before water, was see if I could get internet service. I don't have a landline phone. We don't have cable TV. We don't have satellite. It's all Hulu. Mm-hmm. I got my cell phone. And where I live, out in Jasper County, there's only one provider for where I live. AT&T. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If I Georgia Power and City Water Supply. That's it. So if I'm cut off from that, I work online a lot, as well as the political parties. As I do research, and all my work's done online. So if I'm cut off from that, there's nothing I can do anymore.
But do you see it going that route, though, with the government being involved?
I can see them going that way, yeah.
Because, I mean, for many, many years now, there's very, very strict. Like, if you losing your power, if you're going to, like, the three strikes, you lose your power to your house, or you lose your water, that just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So, and the reason that doesn't happen is because there's a lot of commissions and groups set up to prevent that. I'm wondering if those things might make the jump, because it's like that with cable and, well, it's like that with phone. If you are not denied home phone service, you can't get a 911 service to come to your house.
Mm-hmm.
If you're denied cable television, we could all argue that that's not that important, but it is to a lot of people, and there's commissions set up to prevent that as well. But do you see that maybe going that way? Like, what do you guys, directly, how do you feel about that?
I really do think something like that will come about. And I think as people realize the importance, I really do think a lot of people in power still kind of see it as kind of a toy. It's something that's a luxury. It's fun to play on. You can, you know, see videos and chat. But they don't get that for the technology sector. If you have a job in that, or really anything, like legal, most of my job, I don't do it in my office. I mean, most of my research, my writing, I can do it from anywhere, and I'm expected to be able to do it from anywhere. So, and the thing is, as all these merge, like as wireless, like through a cell phone, becomes also internet, I think you're going to see a lot of these things start to be realized that these are fundamental. I don't know if I'd classify it as a human right, but very fundamental to surviving or to living.
I personally see it going the same way. There's actually been talk, I think it was a year ago, about a universal broadband fund. It's been postulated mm-hmm. by the FCC and by Congress about rolling out internet to the rural areas, mainly using versions of 3G and 4G,
mm-hmm.
because it's easier than laying cables. But Finland, for example, has gone that way. Last month, I believe, they certified, it might have been a bit longer ago, that the internet was a right. Internet connection was a fundamental, you know, utility. So, you know, the access to it had to be sort of promised, even if not exactly guaranteed, although the quality and the speed mm-hmm. still kind of flexible.
You know, I think what's really going to, I've kind of postulated what is going to be the spark that really gets this talked about, and something that it still amazes me, because I grew up when Zach Morris had a cell phone, and that was the coolest kid I'd ever seen, and if you had a beeper, you were a drug dealer. Like, that's my age. But kids now, kids get a lot of their homework assignments through the internet. They need to be able to type. They need to be able to, you know, access online stuff. A lot of teachers post, you know, assignments online on their web pages. And it's going to be interesting when, you know, say your brother who's a teenager, your dad or your mom does something to get internet kicked off, and now your child can't get his homework assignments. Like, I really think it's going to have to take something that really gets people to realize that it's not a toy. It's something that affects people that are young, people that are old. No matter what type of, you know, career or lifestyle you have, you know, it affects everyone.
And it's a big issue. I mean, my son's sitting there, right there, fourth row, and we track all his grades and all his teacher assessments online through the website. That's, mm-hmm. that's our main point of contact now with his school. The same with my elder daughter and our youngest one as well. So without that, you know, we can't keep track of his how he's doing at school quite as well. So I can certainly see it becoming that way and becoming more focused and more protected.
Yes, I wanted to hear your opinion on digital rights management technology and if you think it's a deterrent or an inconvenience to users.
I think it's been proven that DRM doesn't work and has never worked. The only people who are inconveniences are the legitimate users. In 2009, I did some research for Torrent Freak, which proved that Spore was the most pirated game ever. It was 50% more than the nearest competitor, which was The Sims 3. I happen to know Will Wright fairly well. We used to work on BattleBots together about 10 years ago. And the DRM in Spore made headline news. You know, you could only do it on three PCs ever. Three PC configurations. And you had to have an internet connection to set it up and validate it. But in 6 months, it was pirated more than The Sims 3, which had been out for 18 months. And every game on that top 10 used DRM. It was something like 1.9 million copies of Spore in 6 months.
And I believe Spore was also leaked a week early online.
It was an incomplete one, but yeah, it doesn't work. It never has. All you need is for one person to circumvent it, upload it to the internet, and then everybody is. And the only people stuck with it are the legitimate users.
So do you believe that DRM shouldn't exist at all in any form, since it's so easily circumvented?
If the only job of it is to punish the legitimate users, what is its reason for existence? Yeah, I don't believe in it.
I work at a major university in information security, and I actually have to process the takedown requests for our department. Normally, our campus does a three strikes process. If they get a complaint, they turn in the name of the person, and then the complainant has to talk directly to the offender. And if they want to say no, that really wasn't an infringement, then they can battle it out, and we step out of the process. However, my department had a different policy. If there was a complaint, we actually investigated. Now, mind you, that investigation might take me a day or two, and since we have root access to all the machines, I collect evidence. And so when I actually go before our dean of students and say, here's the evidence, and I hand them the DVD with all the stuff, we've got you dead to rights, you were pirating. Now, what's interesting is these cases that are listed right here, they did pirate. Okay? Now, the corollary to the issue of, well, they make all these false accusations, the interesting thing is how many false accusations have I actually seen in practice? Very few, like two. And those two were actually against research projects that were doing research about piracy and were mistaken for doing piracy. And when they said, excuse me, we're doing research for you, and they went, oh, never mind. All the cases with a student where where somebody said, hey, somebody's pirating this, in every case, they were in fact pirating. So at one point, I had to go before my department and justify our budget and say, yes, you are spending this inordinate amount of money and time on our part to collect all this evidence, to prove this person's guilty. And if they were guilty, we cut them off at the knees. And the immediately, there was no three strikes, anything. You're busted, you know. And they said, what are we getting out of that? Because we could simply go to the three strikes rule. It cost us nothing because we don't have to collect evidence, and it's up to them to battle it out. And in reality, every person you've ever investigated has turned out to be guilty. So from that perspective, from our perspective, the three strikes saves me a whole lot of money, and we've never seen anybody illegitimately prosecuted.
Well, there is a case that, you know, there are people who do pirate, and they are accurate, but you got a system that's, say, 97% or 98% accurate. There's still that 1% or 2%, 3% who can't, and then they're cut off and they've got no recourse. A lot of these things, these three strikes laws, the problem is they're extrajudicial. You've gone, you've collected evidence, and you've put it to a board with a given and effectively judicial power, pre-agreed. In France, you get two notices. They can't be contested. When it was struck down by the French Constitutional Court, it was because it could not be contested in court. There was no judicial process. So you get notice, and they've not had it. Under the current three strikes process, though, you'd have had two more people basically getting cut off because, you know, we're doing research for you. Didn't matter. Nobody did evidence. The allegation was enough.
Well, actually, we didn't cut them off. In fact, we act as kind of an arbitrator. So if the person does get busted three times and they come to us and say, look, it wasn't me. Well, we can go back and look at net flows. We can go back and look at evidence and say, wow, that really wasn't you. We're not going to cut you off. Mm-hmm. And then we go to bat. Okay, so we, in some essence, act as an arbitrator even for the three strikes. We're not... I see it as my job as the enforcer to make sure we don't cut off somebody illegitimately. The interesting thing is I've never found people cut off who were, in fact, cut off illegitimately. They were, in fact, pirating.
When you send that, when you respond to the people who sent you the notices, do you tell them that you're going to conduct an investigation?
No, we don't. And we saw that as a... In our own best interest, we saw that as enforcing it as a good thing because people were effectively using resources we'd given them for one purpose for evil. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about the rest of you, but evil sucks. And so I don't like it. And amazingly enough, nobody else likes evil being done to them. But they don't think, like you pointed out earlier, when it's the game developer you know getting mm-hmm. pirated, all of a sudden it's personal. Well, people don't think of that, and that's part of our job at a university is to educate them. Oh, amazingly enough, Americans tend to kind of know that, although they'll step outside the bounds anyway. The interesting thing is the cultural issue. There are other cultures where it's not seen as a problem. Mm-hmm. They don't see it as a problem. They have no problem with it at all. It's not even construed as even being slightly morally reprehensible. It's just quite okay.
One, I think the fact that you put that much time into the investigation is fantastic. Like, I have no issue with cutting someone off if they are legitimately infringing. My biggest concerns with this are, as he said, very few programs or institutions will dedicate the time or the resources to investigating it. And kind of like you said, because most of these takedown notices are automated processes, you know, thousands can go out a day. If you're an institution and you've got 1,000 cases to investigate, at some point you're just going to quit investigating. And so it's just, you know, it's kind of something bred into, I think, being an American is you're innocent until proven guilty. So on one hand, I completely respect, you know, the copyright owner's rights. I mean, that's what I do for a living. And like you say, when you know that person and you see the harm that's been done to them, it does get personal. But we do need to make sure that if there is some sort of scheme put in place, that we do ensure that there are the resources to make sure that it's correct and that it is, you know, a legitimate infringement, that someone has a right to redress, and that there is evidence taken.
And as you've said, you started from the perspective mm-hmm. of they're innocent, here's the evidence, they're proven guilty.
Right.
And the way these three strikes work is you're guilty, prove to us that you're innocent. And that's the biggest problem of them all.
Just say real quick, it seems that the issue with that, what you're talking about with you have to shut off people from the network, why are you actually responsible for that? Like, getting to the root of it, why does it really matter to the university? And should maybe we be addressing that? Why are they able to say to you, you have one of your users, and that's your problem? But it's their problem with what the user is doing with you have just provided a service to the users. That's it, just to connect. What their abuse and the harm that they're doing to the copyright holder, that's the copyright holder's issue.
One thing, and I really haven't seen any cases that do this, but one of the kind of threats that's not mentioned a lot but is legitimate and has been used in other areas very effectively is what's known as vicarious liability. Vicarious liability means that if you, like say a university, you're housing students, you give them internet access. If you are aware of infringement and you benefit from it, which means, you know, you have a student, he's paying tuition, you're getting money, you're giving him this service, you are just as guilty as him if you don't do something to prevent it. So you actually have to put some sort of programs in place to protect yourself. Otherwise, you know, if your students are downloading stuff and the students get say the students get sued for $1 million. Students don't have any money. University has money. Time to sue the university.
That's the very topic that the Pirate Bay trial was based on, was vicarious liability, because they profited from it. That's the purpose of the Oink takedown in 2008. Pirate Bay, other raids, ISO hunt in Canada, and then being argued in Los Angeles. You're profiting from it, so you're liable.
To some extent, this vicarious liability is actually cultural. That's not universal around the world. I lived in Japan for 3 years. They don't. They may have it now, but back then in the 60s, they did not have this as a concept. The idea is, here in the U.S., if somebody falls in a swimming pool and you just stand there and watch them drown, you're going to jail. Mm-hmm. If you do that in Japan, you're expected not to jump in and save them because of the issue of honor. If you save somebody's life, effectively they were in control of their life, and you forcibly remove them from control of their life and save them is a huge dishonor culturally for them. So you just don't do that. But here, it's your fault if you don't save them. And so that's part of the vicarious liability, and it is, to some extent, cultural.
Just to add on to that, you're slightly wrong in that if you had absolutely nothing to do with them falling in, you were just literally just a bystander, then and only then you don't have a responsibility.
That's correct.
If you tripped, if it was slick, it's your fault, if you bumped the guy, if you go, oh, I'll save you, then you're liable. But if you're a pure bystander, no liability.
It wouldn't be responsibility whenever you claim responsibility.
Right, somewhere. Oh, it's whenever you claim responsibility for the situation, then you're liable.
All right, I think we've got 3 minutes till the next presentation, so we're going to wrap it up. Is there any more questions?
No.
All right.
Well, we want to thank you all for coming and thank our speakers for doing all their homework and bringing it to us.
And, guys, I want to thank you all for some of those great questions. They were really thought-provoking. I really had a great time, and I hope to see you all around the con. Feel free to come by and talk to me.
Yeah, I found some of these questions to be very enlightening and gave me a lot to think about, especially the IPv6 systems and the networking responsibilities.
Thank you.